Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Department may house the most powerful military ever known, but it's also housing the world's biggest bureaucracy. All those people in that five-sided building, it's expensive. DOD officials have identified tens of billions of dollars in potential savings, but they can't seem to get there. Part of the problem is lack of data. That's according to the Government Accountability Office. Joining me with more, John Pendleton, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the GAO. Mr. Pendleton, good to have you back.
Glad to be here, Tom.
You looked at all of the cost containment and cost streamlining issues that the DOD has tried to put together for several years running now.
Absolutely. You know, DOD started headquarters-related and overhead-related efficiency initiatives back in 2010. And they've picked up the pace since then, in part because Congress has increased pressure. And between 2010 and 2014, DOD actually announced five separate efforts to reduce overhead. Our report updates some of that information. It looks at key initiatives that have been started since 2014, and it also looks at the data underpinning the system, specifically whether the department has reliable information about headquarters functions, you know, what people are doing.
So what did you find? I mean, how good is their information?
The core of our mandate was to look at how the department was performing functional reviews, right? Large organizations, and DOD is one of the biggest. It has many complex and overlapping relationships, to say the least. But to get efficiencies, you have to look across and up and down to find them. But you can't just look organization by organization. And what we found was the department had a lot of initiatives ongoing, and part of the reason they had to get so many things going was traceable to a lack of good data about what people are doing. If you take it real simple, when you start any of these sort of efforts, you need to know what you need and what you have. And our past work has shown that the department does not have good processes to identify and periodically revalidate their manpower needs. And that's one thing, knowing what you need, but that's even too simple. You need to know what you have so you can actually analyze that, particularly as you do functional reviews. And we found a lot of gaps in the data that underpin that.
Now, does this only concern the DOD Secretary's office, or does this go deeper than just the Secretary's office? Or wider,
you know,
I should say wider.
Yeah, so stepping back a bit, let's talk first about what the department has ongoing. DOD did an internal review in 2014-2015 to try to get a sense of what was possible, and they actually found they thought they could save over $80 billion across the department by streamlining contracts and other things. Now, this goes beyond headquarters, obviously. We went to the department and said, okay, talk to us about the initiatives you have going on now, and specifically to try to get at some of those savings targets. And more specifically, to reduce headquarters, but not limited to that. And we found four things that were ongoing, none of which were finished. A business systems process review. They're looking at nine organizations within OSD. They'd done five, but they weren't done yet, so it was unclear how much that was going to save. They're ongoing now is an effort to delayer the Office of Secretary of Defense. There's an initial estimate that they could save about $1.5 billion by 2021 by doing that, and I know some folks in OSD that are going through that right now. These things are no fun for folks. The Service Requirements Review Board is another initiative, and that's where any service contract above a certain threshold, I believe it was $10 billion, is going to be reviewed, and they expect that to save about $1.9 billion by 2021. And then the granddaddy, the Goldwater-Nichols Review, which some of your listeners may have heard of, is ongoing as well, kind of taking a top-to-bottom review of organizations and their responsibilities, and it'll be several months before we hear much about that. So the efforts go well beyond just OSD and the service secretaries. They're trying to look all the way up and down the department.
In some sense, they all interrelate because a service contract might be doing some of the functions that cross over all of these organizations. And so if you only look at the service contracts, you might be perhaps leaving out the functions that it serves in many different locations.
No, it is. I mean, so we started, we didn't know what we were going to find. We never do. But, I mean, we wanted to look at how the department was looking at things functionally. The work that we've done several reports over the last few years looking at various parts of DOD, and consistently we talk about data problems and the need to validate manpower requirements in individual organizations, but that's not enough. You need to know what people are doing, like I said. So we looked at the FITIP. The information was not good. We looked at Defense Manpower Data Center. It was not good. There's this thing called the Inherently Governmental Commercial Activities Report that's a purpose-built thing. And there are function codes in that. So we dug into that, my analysts did. And there are, in fact, about 38 headquarters functions in there. But there were data reliability problems there. Less than 80% of OSD, for example, was considered a headquarters in that, which we weren't quite sure how they figured that out. And again, the underlying problem, which we point out in this report, is a lack of clarity about what constitutes a headquarters. Now, let me give you some numbers that I jotted down this morning that really illustrate this, right? There's three main places that in 2015 that DOD reported how many people it had in headquarters. The Defense Manpower Requirements Report, it's a report to Congress, they've been doing it for more than 20 years, indicated that there were 108,000 people in headquarters. The Inherently Governmental Commercial Activities Report said that there were 74,000 people in headquarters. And then Congress required a report, Section 904 of the National Defense Authorization Act, and it indicated there was 61,000 people in headquarters. And so this all points to the underlying problem, which is the department really hasn't yet settled on what constitutes a headquarters and use a consistent definition for that.
We're speaking with John Pendleton, Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the GAO. So if we could kind of summarize, bring this all together, the Defense Department has a need to cut costs of whatever you want to define headquarters as.
Right.
And I guess you could maybe define it as what's in the Pentagon, but also maybe some of the large commands.
Absolutely.
That are not located in the Pentagon. Their leaders might be in those regions and so forth. What's the fundamental thing they need to do to be able to start getting these reductions?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the foundational matter is identifying what it is we mean by headquarters and getting good information on that. But that's going to take a couple of years. In the meantime, I mean, I have to give the department credit. There's a lot of very bright spotlights being put on this. I mean, if you look at the combatant commands, these regional combatant commands that, you know, manage operations around the world, if you look outside Central Command, which has got a lot of ongoing work, we also published a report recently that indicated there's 22,000 authorized military and civilian personnel, but only about 30% of them are actually in the combatant command. The other 70 are in subordinate organizations that support them, military service component commands, joint task forces that have been stood up. And so, again, I bring that up to sort of pick up on your point and say this is the reason we need to have good information about what people are doing, because they're all after a consistent mission set. We've done work in the past that indicated that the folks at the combatant command, the four-star command, don't know, you know, what people in the organization subordinate them are doing. And it's not a very efficient way to run a railroad. I think it really comes down to transparency and visibility of information. But, again, I think it's also going to come down to some just tough decisions. In the end, you'll save more inefficiencies if you say you're doing the same or similar things in multiple locations. Let's say you're, you know, making widgets 20 places. You might be able to only make it 2 or 5 or 3 or even 1, and that actually is a great efficiency initiative. It helps to focus on these headquarters, but that's a relatively small proportion and not going to result in $80 or $100 billion in savings, like the department's saying.
It strikes me that there's a big possibility to double count people. Suppose you have a logistics leader somewhere who's maybe headquarters related and is also on a task force to do something that's interagency within DOD. Who knows, 3 or 4 people could be counting that individual as part of their operation.
That's absolutely the case, and it runs the other way, too. You can mask people, right? We saw a situation where one organization might be counting 70% of its people as part of a headquarters, and another like organization was counting a far lower percentage. And so you can mask the true size. We did a report in 1997, actually. It's ancient history, but I think it's relevant, that indicated that the actual size of headquarters was much larger than what was being reported because the incentive was to not count people as part of the headquarters count. So, yes, they can absolutely be double counted, and it's hard to exactly figure out, you know, where to attach people, but on the other hand, that provides a lot of opportunities to shift people around. And so, again, just get it. And again, it's not easy. If it was easy, they would have already done it. But it's foundationally, you have to have it. Or whenever you have a budget difficulty like this, you have to spin up and do a bunch of emergency things, and you have to create the data from scratch, which is not a great way to run a railroad.
John Pendleton is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management Issues at the GAO. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You can read his report and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The race is on in NASCAR, not the automobiles, but something more complicated. The Defense Information Systems Agency and the DoD Chief Information Officer are taking a comprehensive review of two networks. The secure and non-secure IP networks known as CIPRNET and NIPRNET. Add the words Cybersecurity Architecture Review and you've got the car racing acronym. Joining me with the goals for NASCAR and how they get there, Peter Dinsmore, the Risk Technology Executive at DISA. Mr. Dinsmore, great to have you on.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Exactly what are you doing with this architecture review called NASCAR?
What we're doing with NASCAR is we're evolving our cybersecurity architecture, which we call the cybersecurity reference architecture, as necessary, and creating an implementation strategy, what to do next, what things interact with each other for the infrastructure, both the unclassified and classified, as you mentioned, based on an end-to-end holistic review. So we look at everything in one picture from the endpoint to the perimeter. And what's new is we're using a rationale based on what the adversary is doing. So we're looking at the adversary's lifecycle and how they approach their activities trying to attack the Department of Defense. And that's informed by our threat data, both classified and unclassified threat data.
Now, just to detail, I always thought that CIPRNET was completely air-gapped from the Internet. Is that still true?
That's still true. There are... But we worry about ways that the adversary might find to break that air gap, as well as there's been a lot of talk in the press about insider threats. And we have insider threats, of course, on both NIPR and, unfortunately, on CIPRNET.
Okay, and NIPRNET, both of these have been around quite a long time. And I imagine from a sheer technical component standpoint, they've changed a lot since originally conceived.
Yes, and part of this is looking at where we are today, given all those changes, and then what's the best next change to make based on taking the adversary's perspective. So where do we think the adversary, where do we think we are not doing the best job possible of slowing down the adversary in their life cycle of trying to attack the Department of Defense?
And when you say adversary, I mean, there's the classic adversary, say, of an enemy nation trying to break in and get military secrets. But really, the term adversary can apply to a range of activities you don't want, I imagine.
It does. And we use it in a very broad sense. So we use that term adversary across the whole spectrum of adversaries, whether it's a domestic person trying to see what they might be able to do or not, up to, as you mentioned, the nation state.
So it sounds like you're almost going to use the banking term, pressure test these networks.
We're not actually doing any penetration testing. We're doing an analysis based on the threat data that we've collected and our understanding of how our capabilities operate.
And where does the threat data come from?
It comes from both public sources and from our own internal sources of what we have collected that the adversaries have been able to do on public networks in general, that tell us the threat techniques they're using, as well as from our own incident response data.
Does that mean you have tools that monitor different aspects of these networks and report out in their logs and so forth activities?
Yes. And then we also have had intrusions, and we do after-action analysis on those intrusions to really understand the steps that the adversary has taken.
So is this basically, I said pressure test, but you corrected me. It sounds like more maybe of a data analysis type of exercise.
Yes, it is. That's a very good term, a data analysis exercise. But it gives us insights by looking at all the data holistically and looking at it together from the endpoint to the perimeter. It gives us insights that you don't otherwise get if you're looking at just an intrusion that occurred at the perimeter without considering how all the pieces can work together.
We're speaking with Peter Dinsmore, the technical executive for the Development and Business Center at the Defense Information Systems Agency. And how will you get this analysis done? Is contractors going to come in and do it, or is it just a staff or a combination?
It's a combination. I think, as you mentioned at the beginning, NASCAR was chartered with DISA and the Department of Defense CIO's office, as well as NSA, the National Security Agency, and we have support from U.S. Cyber Command, the Defense Cybercrime Center, and the Component Command Services and Agencies. And so the team is comprised of our staffs, and then all of our staffs are augmented by some contractors. But it's very much government-led and run, and we do have some contractor support.
And you have said in the CHIPS article about this that NASCAR is being implemented as an agile process on a spin concept with a new spin cycle every 90 days. Sounds like a washing machine. Tell us what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is many times analyses like this take a year or two, and you get a report in a year because you try to incorporate everything you can think of at one time. So we have taken our cue from agile software development, where we try to incorporate just a little bit of information each time so we have something new to say, and more importantly, we can incorporate something that's happening today and get an analysis of that in the next 90 days rather than having to wait a year for the next report to come out.
So as these reports come out and show something, say an anomaly or a weakness, then you would want to correct them right then and there.
Correct. And we're informing our own agencies and the Department of Defense CIO about what we find, and that informs and influences their investment processes and decisions as to how they spend money and where they accept risk in our cybersecurity portfolio.
We know what DISA is doing, and is the DOD CIO simply going to take in what you give them, or do they have an active role in the whole NASCAR also?
They have a whole active role in NASCAR, and then they'll take our recommendations from that analysis, and they will use them with other reasoning and other requirements and policy that they are trying to implement in making their final decisions.
And so as an agile process, then, will NASCAR pretty much go on indefinitely? Because once you wind up a complete look at everything, you might want to start over again in 2 years.
Exactly. I do believe NASCAR is an enduring process because the threat continues to change. The investments that we might possibly make continue to change as industry brings us new ideas. And where the adversary is focused continues to change. So as we continue to learn of new threats and new cyber capabilities, we need to continue to do this holistic analysis to see how that information changes our investment profile.
And what's your biggest fear that might be happening on CIPRNet or NIPRNet? Would it be data exfiltration?
My biggest fear is really the adversary determining the ability to harm our network or take away our ability to use our network.
Are you also looking at not just what's happening, but this idea of dwell time, where something might be in a network but not do anything until a predetermined period, which is predetermined by the adversary? And so if you can discover it before they can detonate it, so to speak, that seems to be a growing issue in cyber.
Right. So as part of our holistic look, we as I mentioned, we're looking across the adversary lifecycle. So part of that includes the specific techniques that an adversary would use for that dwell time to remain in the network. And part of our analysis is how does that fit into our overall cybersecurity architecture, and how and when do we want to address that?
So you would be looking at, say, technical profiles of malware, but also looking at behavior patterns of different elements on the network?
Yeah, we look across all of the different what we call techniques or actions that an adversary will take to accomplish their ultimate goal. And ideally, you stop them in multiple places, but if we don't stop them in the first step that they take, can we stop them in the second step that they take or the third step that they take to break that adversary life cycle before they accomplish their ultimate objective?
You've also talked about the idea of recommendations, affirmations, and observations with respect to this NASCAR effort. What do you mean by that one?
NASCAR produces a report, and in that report, we put forward recommendations, affirmations, and observations. And the difference is that recommendations are recommending a change. Many times it's something we see we need to do that we haven't done yet. The affirmations are equally important because it's the results of the analysis that say, keep doing what you're doing. It's accomplishing what you need from this holistic review. And then the observations are where we see opportunities to gain efficiencies or change the effectiveness or do further research on some of our cybersecurity capabilities. And we want to make sure NASCAR provides a balance between the three rather than just saying the changes to make and then the danger is people make the changes at the detriment of what you're already affirming. So folks need to understand the balance between the recommendations, affirmations, and observations.
Peter Dinsmore is Technical Executive for the Development and Business Center at the Defense Information Systems Agency. Thanks so much for joining me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.